and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am Scott Nye.
I am David Bax.
And thank you for listening. You usually don't leave the space. You usually just launch right into it. I've been waiting
I did the opportunity one with Tyler.
To say, yeah, yeah. No. I've been waiting for that opportunity this whole time. Yeah. And now finally I have it and I spaced. Thank you for listening. David, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm like trepidatious about, I guess, but by the time you're hearing this, I'm probably back from Toronto or still in Toronto, but I'm
when getting you come ready back?
To head out to Toronto. I come back Monday evening. So if I get my shit together to schedule this to post Sunday night, like I normally would.
And we have very attentive listeners.
Yeah. Otherwise, I will just post it when I get home on Monday. Anyway, I'm heading off to Toronto. I don't want to, like, this is total like humble bragging or looking a gift horse in the mouth. Like, for the second year in a row, I've had some trouble getting the tickets that I wanted, which, like, it's just strange because the first 2 years I went pre-COVID, I almost got everything I wanted, you know, including like big premieres of like Knives Out and stuff like that. And it seems to have really changed. I don't know if there are fewer press tickets overall or what, but I don't want to sound like I'm complaining. I know that it's
David's just making a note in case listeners are reading the reviews and they're like, why is he reviewing this shit? I heard these huge movies premiere at Toronto. Why does David care about I don't even know what obscure thing would be playing at TIFF.
But that's a good, this wasn't what the top of the topic show, the top of the show topic was going to be, but we can call an audible and make this the top of the show topic. From an outsider's perspective, meaning someone who is not going to TIFF and probably has not been poring over the schedule in this weird strike delayed year, what do you think are the big movies that are premiering at TIFF?
Oh God, I don't know. Partially because my feed has just been nothing but Venice Film Festival stuff.
Right.
I'm like, I don't know. Is this stuff playing at TIFF? Probably. I don't know. You guys got a Maestro?
No, that's what I'm saying. These big things like TIFF.
You guys got Poor Things?
No, this is okay. Part of it is the strike, I think. But also part of it is that I think TIFF as a festival retracted during COVID, and I don't know that it will ever get to the size that it was in the past. You know, this is the second year that this is the second year in a row that two of the major venues that they used in past years they aren't using anymore. I don't know what I'm trying to look at, like, what are the star vehicles?
Yeah, have they replaced those venues with anything? Because like
they replaced one of them.
Okay. I was thinking, like, to use a local analogy, like TCM Fest lost the Egyptian, gained a Legion, you know?
Yeah. Now this, they stopped using, no, it's actually three venues, because I forgot there's two theaters in one. So there was the Winter Garden and the, and now I'm forgetting what it was even called, but that was two theaters in one that they stopped using. Then they also stopped using what was then called the Ryerson, but Ryerson University is no longer called Ryerson University because I don't know if you remember those stories in recent years about like
where Ned Ryerson was canceled. Sure.
I mean, not Ned Ryerson, but about like First Nations, like Native peoples in America, like finding mass graves at the former schools So Ryerson, like the guy that school was named after, was kind of like the architect of those schools as well. So the school's not even called Ryerson anymore, and they're not even using the that auditorium anymore, which is a blessing and a curse. It was a really cool place to see a movie that I have a lot of good memories of. And also I had like figured out where the secret hidden bathroom was that it was never a line for.
That's gold at a film festival.
Yeah. But it was also the furthest flung from the, like, so that's like the cool thing about TIFF now is that, like, once you're there for the day, you're in this, like, you know, 4-block radius, and that's all you have to do. You don't have to, to hike all over, creation. I guess this is all to say, like, I don't really know what, you know, I mean, like last year you had the Fablemans premiering at TIFF. You had the Whale, I think. Did the Whale premiere? No, the Whale premiered at Venice, but it played TIFF. But the Fablemans premiered at TIFF. And I just feel like this year, I mean, there's definitely some cool stuff that I'm looking forward to, but
yeah, I listened to the preview episode and there was definitely a lot of stuff that perked my ears up. But
yeah, that's like for us, I'm saying like,
yeah.
Did any of those sound like a major, like best picture contender?
You know? No, I mean, maybe like a Holdovers.
Holdovers is a big one. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the only one that's kind of coming to mind that I can recall from that episode.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, there's still a lot of stuff I'm looking forward to seeing, even if I don't get all the tickets that I initially asked for. It seems like right now I'm really hoping this isn't the case. I'm hoping I can find a way to get in. Right now, the biggest one that I want to see that it looks like I'm going to miss is Perfect Days, the Vim Vendors. I just don't have a slot for it. But I've reached out to the publicist to ask for a ticket because it's out. But I'll keep trying because they like people return tickets and I can get it. And then I'm really looking forward to His Three Daughters, the new Azazel Jacobs movie.
Oh yeah, who's in that?
Who is in that? It's a good cast.
Yeah, I remember reading about it and let's see.
So that one also is it's a possibility I might not get to see that, but I'm still getting to see. I've got a ticket for The Zone of Interest, which was like my number one.
Oh, that's
see.
Good. Yeah.
So that's cool. His Three Daughters is Natasha Lyonne, Elizabeth Olsen, and Carrie Coon.
Yeah, that's
That's great.
Pretty good.
And I think his last movie was French Exit, which I thought was like, I was sad it kind of like didn't make a big dent or didn't make a big splash, but I loved French Exit.
Yeah, I really liked it as well. Did you see before that? I'm trying to remember.
He did The Lovers before that, which is not bad.
The Lovers, is that...
And he did Terry, which I saw. I didn't see Mama's Man, which I think is the one that like kind of made his name.
Is The Lovers like the middle-aged couples like cheating on each other movie?
Yeah, they're each cheating on each other, but then they like fall back in love.
Yeah,
so then
I was
it's
a little
like
mixed
they're
on
cheating
that one.
On their like side pieces with each other. Yeah,
I was a little mixed on that one, but I did really like French Exit.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, lest we turn this episode into another TIFF preview.
Yeah. Yeah. This person is probably not famous enough to be a celebrity sighting whenever Tyler and I do celebrity sightings again. But Natalie and I were at Tony's Darts Away in Burbank.
Great place.
And we were sitting at the bar and the table behind us was an actress who's in French Exit. Her name's Valerie Mahaffey. I haven't pulled up. Yes. Valerie Mahaffey. She's like in French Exit when they go to France, she's like the American whose apartment they're like.
Yes. Okay.
But you might also know her. You probably, most people would know her. Most people who are like us would know her as, George Costanza's girlfriend who pronounces papier mache, papier mache, right. And calls his doorman, Samuel. anyway, so we're sitting in the bar and I was like, oh shit, like to Natalie, I was like, oh shit, that Valerie Mahaffey from Seinfeld and stuff and from French Exit. I didn't want to like say it. she was like with friends, but like, so the, like we're getting ready, we're putting our jackets on. This is what last winter, we're like putting our jackets and coats on or whatever. And I just say like, by the way, you were great in French Exit. And she and her friends went like, oh,
like, I mean, how often is she going to get recognized?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, it's probably for Seinfeld, which Natalie was like, we love you on Seinfeld too. But like, she was clearly like so happy that
that's awesome.
Recognized her from that, and yeah, we had a little chat about how like I just said, like it's a shame that more people didn't like see that movie because I really dug it. Okay,
totally.
So that's it. You're right. I almost did turn this into a like, because when at the time that we did that, Tyler and I did the TIFF preview last week, I hadn't selected my tickets. Now I've selected them. I still have some feelers out, but now I have a better idea of what it looks like. So I do want to just talk about like what I'm going to see, but no, there's a whole
future to go.
Yeah. So, let me tell you real quick about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I use them each and every day of my life. I'm torn between, like, I listened to a couple things today that I really want to talk about that couldn't be more different. And, like, out of nowhere, out of left field, very underground black metal band I'd never heard of called Grave Pilgrim. And they had an album called The Bigotry. Their album is called The Bigotry of Purpose. And it's really, like, good, like, raw, like, folk black metal. I really loved it. But then I also liked the new EP from rapper Smoke Dizza and producer Flying Lotus called Flying Objects. That's also very good. I haven't talked a lot about rap this year because I haven't liked as much this year, but I think that could just be me.
Terrible getting... year for rap. Everybody's saying that.
I don't know if they are. I think I'm just getting old. But they, both albums, or the album and the EP, both sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds. They're available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Scott, we're back.
Hello.
And longtime loyal listeners have already noticed that it's been 10 episodes since we talked about the films of Michael Snow, right? That was the last one? Yes.
That's good.
Oh, no, it's been 20 episodes. That's
true. We had a whole, it felt like a while ago.
Yeah, I screwed up the whole thing. It's been 20 episodes because every 10 episodes we do a profile, unless that the number of the episode is evenly divisible by 50. And then we do just a fun thing, which was me and Natalie going to Tyler's hospital room and shooting the shit with him there. So that means we're back to the every 10 episode track. We're back on track and we are ready to talk about the life and career of the late Kenneth Anger.
Yes.
Your mic
at
just
the
went
ripe
out.
Old age of 90 something.
Yeah. Definitely someone I had, like with Michael Snow, someone I was like aware of, but had not actually seen any of his work until he passed away. That seems to be a trend lately because it was the same with Charles Houllet for me. I'd never seen any of them before they passed away. So
the trend is people you haven't seen and who are obscure to our entire listener base. This is the key to the current profile episodes.
Are they obscure to our listener base? Like,
I don't know. I can't speak for our listeners.
I feel like Battleship Retention listeners are people who, like me, at least are aware of Kenneth Anger and Michael Snow and Straub Wiggle, but maybe haven't seen them.
I guess it's the haven't seen them part that I'm...
Yeah, but now we have seen them and we can talk to you about them. Although I will admit I didn't go very far beyond the Magic Lantern cycle, the sort of main... like the core, like 10 films that he's best known for. And then a 2002 film that's on that Blu-ray set as a special feature that I also watched.
I guess I'll be holding up the back half of this episode then.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on with your mic. You're like in or out or like, I don't know.
That's strange. It's
Now you're back.
Huh?
All right.
I'll have to look into that because I'm not getting any, it's a temperamental mic, but it usually like there's a little red indicator if it's connected or not. And it's shown full connection this whole time.
All right. So Kenneth Anger, I guess I want to call him an Angeleno, but let's say he's a Southland native. He was born in Santa Monica, although he would sometimes claim to have been born in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
You cannot trust his backstory.
That's the key first part of all this.
Yeah, yeah. He made up a lot of things about himself and about other people. I mean, before I even knew what his films were, the thing I most knew about Kenneth Anger was Hollywood Babylon, a book in which he basically just made up a bunch of salacious rumors about movie stars. But he would do the same for himself. He at various points claimed to be from Santa Monica or from Beverly Hills. He also like changed his name to Anger from Engelmeyer, but apparently would get belligerent when interviewers asked him about that. there was one quote in an interview where it was like, it says Anger in my birth certificate and it's probably in your best interest that we leave it there.
Yeah, I think that was in the booklet on the BFI set.
Oh, that's when I read that, yeah.
Which was very amusing.
He also claimed to have been in was it William Dieterle's A Midsummer Night's Dream? It was a
whatever the 30s one is, which is a really great movie. Yeah.
I've never seen that one.
Oh, it's they showed it at TCM Fest one year. That's how I saw it. And like it was the first show of the day, which is a lot to jump into, but it's a really good movie. I cannot speak to whether or not he's in it.
Yeah, no one can.
It seems doubtful. Because the story was that he like, so the character he's playing is a boy, but his mom dressed him up as a girl to get the role or something like that. It was, I can't remember the exact like confluence of things, but essentially like there's so many layers removed that it'd be impossible to verify or not.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you've got the fluid sexuality, the gender questioning at an early role or early age, perhaps, if that's true, which it probably isn't. But do you have any other background before we get into the films?
I don't think so. Other than that, I was like, I wasn't aware he was as active as he was as a filmmaker so early. Like, I kind of think of him as like a 60s, 70s guy. But the first film we'll talk about is from 1947. And he made films before then that he has since destroyed. I don't like, apparently the legend goes that like he just marched in the offices that like held these negatives one day and just like burned them
in front of Jonas Mekas, apparently.
Yeah, and they're kind of recurring stories like that throughout his career, so he has an interesting filmography to try to dig through because so much of it is literally unavailable.
But Fireworks, which he was, if we're going with the facts, as we understand them, was like 20 years old when he made, though he claimed he was still 17 when he made it.
Yeah.
Again, he just liked to make up stuff about himself. But Fireworks is pretty incredible. And I think kicks off with, there are kind of two main like paths or threads in his films, which is fetish and the occult.
Sure.
And sometimes they overlap, but sometimes movies like definitely lean more towards one or the other. And Fireworks definitely is more of a fetish film, but it's also very interesting to think about a film that came, a clearly homoerotic film that came out of a time when there was even more. It's an understatement to even say there's discrimination. It was like against the law to be gay. And you can see that in the way the film, I think the violence the film culminates in, I think probably comes from that tension building and the fact that there's no legal, you know, safe release at this time.
Yeah, for sure. I wasn't surprised to hear his influence by Jean Cocteau's Blood of a Poet, because it deals with a lot of that same kind of like dreamlike imagery and sort of like constructed sets and someone moving through kind of a dream space. And he kind of summarized it in, I can't remember if I read this in the booklet or on Wikipedia, but like that it summed up all his feelings about being 17 and the Navy and just kind of the general homosexual culture at the time, which it does feel even abstractly like it's kind of on the fringes and kind of something done secretly and somewhat illicitly, but without being explicit exactly. Like, it is definitely erotic, but it's not sexually explicit, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah, which I was
a longing there without it being like showing, like, you know, people going at it.
Yeah, which, given that I had read the stories about how, like, he had to face, like, obscenity charges and stuff like that, like, I was expecting something more explicit.
Naturally.
But it's all just very suggestive and lots of shirtless men and rippling muscles. But then, you know, there's... So this is one that's been longest since I've watched, but there's, like, even before there's literal, like... human violence, there is still power. There's like hammer strikes or whatever, like, am I, or is some shoveling? I can't remember the exact shots I'm thinking of. But then it does culminate in
pretty bloody stuff.
Some surprisingly gory stuff. Yeah. I hate to keep saying this, but your mic is like all over the place.
Got it. I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah. Scott is fiddling, not hearing anything, so I don't know what he's working on.
I mean, I fiddled, I don't know.
Now, I mean, now it's coming through strong.
Hopefully it stays that way.
I hope so too. So yeah, that's fireworks. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on fireworks.
No, I mean, I was just pretty struck and impressed with it pretty immediately, and it really announced a vision of his career that I was, I think, more on board with than some other stuff that will come up as his career develops.
Oh.
But the kind of like tapping into the surrealist culture of the early 20th century was very cool to me. And just reading about the production of it, that it was like he just like enrolled his friends from the Navy and just kind of like shot it in either his own house or a house that he had access to. Again, mythologies about it vary. But which seems like it really holds like a lot of the energy of a young person's filmmaking without seeming like overly impressed with itself. It's like curious and daring and adventurous. But it doesn't have any of the like self-satisfaction that I feel like a lot of young filmmakers have. And so, you know, it's likelier that he made it 20 than 17, but at any rate, like to make something like this at 20, that is this like out there is very cool.
Yeah. I should say at the beginning of this, I was talking about the other, like Michael Snow and Straub Huile. I was really blown away by a lot of that stuff. But I think I love Kenneth Anger's movies. I think he's made quite an impression on
me. Oh yeah. And, same.
And that BFI, disc, or set, was a godsend.
Yeah. I mean, people who have been tracing these episodes know that I wasn't as into the Straub Huile, and then, Wavelength was the only one of the Michael Snow ones. So I was like, okay, this is really seriously one of the best things I've seen. There were several, in the Kenneth Anger kind of stuff I went through that made a huge impression on me, and fireworks was prime among them.
Yeah. So then the next one chronologically on the set, and like the longest movie that I watched, I think, is like 40 minutes.
I got one that's 45. Watch out.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So he worked in short film. And one of the shortest is Puce Moment, which,
yeah.
My understanding, it was a, he had planned for a longer film called Puce Women.
Yeah.
This ended up being the only section of it he was able to actually produce, and made Puce Moment, which is 6 minutes of a woman sort of like getting dressed. Is that what it
is? Basically. Did you listen to the commentary tracks for any of these at all?
No, I should have.
Yeah, so amusingly, I didn't get through quite all of them, but amusingly, this one ends with him being like, and then nobody would pay for the rest of this movie. And it's like, over. So yeah, I would have been curious to see what else he would have done, because I really love this one as well. It's kind of engagement with 1920s culture. So his shoot, now I can't remember, but some relative of his was a costume designer for like the silent era. And so a lot of these gowns were drawn from like wardrobe from like Clara Bow films and stuff like that, like film stuff that silent actresses would have worn, which also explains like the weird color patterns of them, that it's like these slightly exaggerated unreal colors that probably looked good in black and white, but which in color just feel like almost kind of gaudy. But you know, in the context of a Kenneth Anger film where like the excessiveness is part of the point of them, it's really mesmerizing to watch them being gradually taken off the rack one by one.
Mm-hmm. A through line in his career that we should probably talk about is that he overlapped with a lot of other artists. There are some other people of note who pop up either in his movies or were involved in them. So the cinematographer for Puce Moment was Curtis Harrington, who also appears in a later film, but he would go on to direct a lot of films I unfortunately haven't seen, but what I do know is that later in his career, in the 70s, he directed two of the like quintessential Grand Dame Guignol movies, the those horror movies where former like famous women are now relegated to being the lead in,
right?
And so he did Whoever Slew Auntie Rue with Shelley Winters, and What's the Matter with Helen, which is Shelley Winters and Debbie Reynolds. Two of the biggest examples of that very interesting subgenre of movies. Curtis Harrington is also, I think he appears in one of the later ones as well.
Yeah, I think he shot a couple of these, but yeah. And then the woman kind of at the center of this is Yvonne Marquis, whom Anger cast because she kind of had the sensation of those silent stars, and that definitely comes across. There is a sense in which the film, I mean, even in 1949, feels like it's alluding to a slightly earlier era, which I think is also like something that recurs throughout his filmography. Like Fireworks is fairly contemporary to when it was shot. I mean, you know, it was premiered in 1949, but in the commentary, you talk about shooting it as early as at least 1942. So it was like very much during the war. Mm. But a lot of his films are referring to kind of like past things, either like the 50s or even earlier than that. And this is very much harkening back to like a sensation of the silent era.
So moving forward from here, we get kind of like dicey between chronologies.
Yeah.
Of when the movies were actually released, because IMDb often has things much later or much earlier than the BFI set that we both watched through has. So I'm not really sure what you want to do next.
I mean, I'm kind of using the Wikipedia list to jump off of, which has Rabbit's Moon next. So that suits me.
But the thing is, cause yeah, I'm also looking at that, but my thing with that though is the BFI set has the 1971 and 1979 versions, and my understanding is the Rabbit's Moon 1950 version is the same cut as the 79 version, but different music, different
soundtrack. Yeah.
So I don't know. I watched the 79. I don't know what music originally soundtracked the 1950 Rabbit's Moon.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't either. But
The 1979 one is kind of like you would call it like rockabilly or horror billy type of like spook rock type of thing, and it's there's a sense of humor and fun to it.
Well, that's true. Did you watch the 71 one as well?
The 71 one, which I also thought was beautiful, was I didn't find it like, I mean, there's some funny stuff, but by not being sped up and by drawing things out and having more shots of the character sort of looking longingly at the moon, I felt there was something like tragic. There was a sadness to the longer cut, which is, by the longer, I mean, it's 16 minutes instead of 7 minutes. Did you feel they were that different?
I guess I definitely felt they were different, but I hadn't really thought of like that kind of deeper emotional level to it. I think I liked the earlier one more, mainly because it was playing music that I tend to like a little bit more. Yeah. But, and it just has, you know.
By the earlier one, you mean the shorter one?
No, sorry. I mean, the 1971 version, the 16 minute version, I preferred a little bit because it had more music I kind of dug. But I mean, in either version, I still thought this was a really interesting effort. I mean, it's kind of like in going through the set, I was struck by that feeling that you sometimes get when you watch like mid-century stuff of like, oh, this is what like The Simpsons was making fun of whenever they had like an art film parody. Is like the first time I watched Persona, I had the same sensation of like, okay, I'm loving this, but also I see now what everyone was making fun of at the time.
Yeah, for me it was last year Marienbad, like,
oh totally,
when you've got two characters talking to one another but facing different directions but speaking in like flat affect, I was like, oh, that's what every like fucking Animaniacs parody of French film was.
So this is a little bit of that, because it's like there's a clown like longing for the moon in a handmade forest and a rabbit pops up from time to time. So it's very like kind of archetypical avant-garde filmmaking, but it's still like really beautifully made, and is all shot either with like a blue filter, or I can't remember if it was this one. It was Udo Artifice, which was a film that he shot on color stock but in a blue filter. I can't remember what the process was for this, but in any event, it appears like it's all blue tinted and has this kind of like animated moon that keeps attacking the clown, and the forest is all completely handmade. He talked about this in the commentary too, where like even the leaves on the ground were hand cut. So it's this really extensively constructed environment that's becomes kind of hypnotizing as it kind of repeats this image of the clown like reaching towards the moon.
Yeah. That I was very much struck by how much work clearly went into this, to the set, the production design, the costumes, the makeup. The clown is. Whose name I'm reading is Pierrot. There's no dialogue.
No dialogue or even like intertitles.
But like his makeup, and then the guy who dances a jig and throws a sword over his head. I don't know what to call these people.
Like, I know.
It's very, what's what I'm looking for? Meticulous.
Yeah, for sure.
But in a way that is not like, that is ultimately beautiful in the way of like, it's artificial, but beautiful in the way of like a classic film or a classic like stage production. And so like his, as much as he was like clearly iconoclastic, as we've already discussed, his like obsession with or fondness for sort of old Hollywood glamour.
Yeah,
comes through in more of these films than just Puce Moment or whatever.
Yeah,
can we move on to Artifice?
Let's do it.
Because I found this so transfixing and so beautiful. It's just a it's a woman. I was trying to look at what because like they're actual fountains, like famous fountains somewhere. But it's just a woman, like you said, blue stock, walking around these fountains, and she's moving very gracefully, and there's constant shots of water in the moonlight. I'm sure it was darkness and like
right.
artificial light, but reflections over moving water or drops of water through the air, and sort of like dissolves and stuff like that. I found the thing just like so trance inducing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was one of my favorites.
Yeah. I mean, it uses as a soundtrack Vivaldi's, Four Seasons. And, this was shot at a location of a real fountain that's in, clicking on the thing, in Italy, near Rome. And apparently he got linked up with the
Villa d'Est, which I think means East Villa.
Let's go.
I'm gonna guess. It's in Tivoli.
The main actress, Carmilla, let's see, Salvatorelli, he met through Federico Fellini, who he talked about this in the commentary that, like, he was like, Fellini knew all the weirdos in Italy. So if I wanted a little person or a bearded lady or strong man or whatever, I'd talk to Fellini. And so this is the woman, he said, is like 3.5 feet tall, which landed a greater sense of scale to the fountains than he might have gotten with, I don't know, taller actress, let's say. And yeah, it's weirdly transfixing and has, like, even though this comes after Rabbit's Moon, the stock feels more degraded, and that might just be like it just wasn't stored under as well good of conditions or whatever. But I think that sense of degradation kind of contributes to the beauty of the film, where it feels a little ethereal, a little out of reach, and much more abstract than, you know, Rabbit's Moon is fantastical, but I don't think it's as abstract as this one.
Yeah. But thus, at least for the time, ends his European period. And he comes back to California after his mother dies, right?
Oh, I didn't know about the mother dies angle.
Yeah, I think that's why he left Europe and came back to California and sort of got in. Because now we're getting into, it's still pre hippie times, which is, it's so fascinating to think about, like, how much the stuff that he made in the 50s looks like the 60s.
Totally. Well, I mean, this is like, I mean, that's literally what avant-garde means, is like kind of at the front of, or right, before, right, it becomes fashionable, is like so much of what he was doing would become part of, if not the mainstream, at least like a portion of filmmaking that accesses a wider audience. But he was just way out ahead of it. So yeah, I mean, Inauguration of the Pleasure Dome, it was a tougher hang for me, maybe, but it's definitely like for 1953, 54, it's way out there.
So, I loved it because I think I like occult stuff maybe more than you.
I think
do,
so, yeah.
As a metalhead. But yeah, this is him getting into the occult stuff. He, in real life, he had attended a party, a costume party that was called Come As Your Madness.
Yeah.
And he was inspired by that to make a sort of film version of that. And that's what Inauguration of the Pleasure Dome is. Now the version that's on the BFI set that we watched is, was restored in 1993, and the music used Leos Janáček's Glagolithic Mass, or Glagolithic Mass, was Anger's original. The first time he showed it, he used it with that, and then it had been showed, I guess, without that, and sort of the BFI restoration restored that music. And we've talked about music a little bit, but it's a huge part of his approach, and he clearly is very clear about what music he selects. You know, we talked about how, for me, Rabbit's Moon, the long and short Rabbit's Moon, are like so vastly different in tone, and largely because of the music, not only because of the music, but largely because of it. And Inauguration of the Pleasure Dome, I don't know if there was a commentary on this one that I should have listened to, but it seemed like it was made to be set to the music that it's set to. I think this was, in this journey of watching these movies chronologically, this is the first one that really struck me of like, oh, because Ode to Artifice has beautiful music too with Vivaldi, but this really struck me like, this is, there's an intentionality to the music.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I will say, like, on a pure craft level, this is a huge leap forward for him, and is much more like, as much as I think, you know, like I said, I kind of prefer Fireworks and the energy that comes with it, but he's doing so much more with Inauguration of the Pleasure Dome that suggests a greater capacity for talent than he would maybe be able to get funding for to that point. And I know he struggled with, I mean, as with every avant-garde artist, struggles with funding their whole career. But there's stuff in this that's like really adventurous as far as the intersection between costuming and set design and editing patterns. You know, there's dissolves that go kind of between each other that's very unusual. And so even if the content of this was not as much my speed, I was pretty taken with the achievement at hand. And yeah, I mean, the music's part of it. I mean, really, it's impressive that he stuck with this kind of approach throughout his whole career of essentially making silent films that he was able to select the score for. You know, maybe most people who made silent films in their era were kind of stuck with the local piano player as their accompaniment, Charlie Chaplin aside. But Anger was able to, you know, through the magic of Sync Sound, select his own soundtrack. But really, right up until the end, he was deciding what that would be. And the marriage between the two does feel more purposeful here in a way that's hard to put my finger on, but which just kind of goes hand in hand with the wider achievement of the film.
I was going to say something about that and I forgot what it was.
Terrific.
But yeah, this, I mean, I'm just happy that we're really into the occult stuff. But then we take a break from the occult stuff and we steer hard back into the fetishism, right with Scorpio Rising.
Yeah. So this is far and away my favorite of all the Kenneth Anger films I saw, which is nothing to diminish the rest of them, only to say that, like, well, partially this is like complete in my wheelhouse, which is like people expressing their fetishes and eroticism on screen, all about it. I we've talked about like kind of the Puritan streak of modern film in general, but even well before that, you know, there's often the tag against filmmakers of like, well, it's just the director getting off on whatever's on screen. And I'm like, yes, I want to see that. I like it when directors are that open about anything that gets them off, whether it's like action or sex or violence or whatever, like id thing is at their core. That is very, very cool to me. So seeing this, which is so enamored of biker culture of the 50s and just kind of taking that in completely, and which has a soundtrack of just like 50s pop hits, which I love already. Yeah. All the songs on it are like songs I listen to regularly. So I like to hear them set so perfectly to a film like this was a joy in and of itself. And also that they're like kind of in conversation with the material in the film. You know, you get stuff like, what's the one that really stood out? Well, Blue Velvet, which of course is like David Lynch would kind of repurpose later on, but which here is just like set to like bikers dressing themselves and kind of like speaks to the inherent fetishization of the biker culture even before, you know, gay culture kind of took it over in itself and kind of reclaimed or kind of claimed in the first place the kind of leather look for its own purposes. It was kind of, this was really identifying that there was an erotic component to it, whether or not the bikers themselves were owning up to it. You know, they, you don't dress yourselves that way accidentally. The point was to make themselves appealing to another person, and Anger just latched onto the homosexual nature or potential of it rather, and then for it to transform into like taking on, I guess, not only like the homoerotic nature of it, which ended up being kind of like accidental, you know, that he have that big kind of party scene that verges on orgy where like all the guys are kind of like pouring stuff on each other while they're like naked. That ended up because the bikers didn't want their girlfriends in the movie, which is like interesting pivot, but okay. But like totally works with what the film is aiming for. Go ahead.
I was going to say, we finally get the male nudity that I was expecting from Fireworks. Totally. I didn't mean to cut you off, but you mentioned Blue Velvet. What else? Which, by the way, Kenneth Anger claimed that Blue Velvet just happened to be playing on the radio. I'm sure that's not true, but Blue Velvet obviously David Lynch would have been aware of this, the Nazi imagery, the Nazi iconography mixed with the biker culture, comes up later in Roger Corman's The Wild Angels. I thought more recently of Amanda Kramer's Please Baby Please from last year, which has a lot of like sexual leather and biker culture. And it's just watching Scorpio Rising was like discovering like the legend that made a whole map make sense. Like I was like, this movie is massively influential. Like we've seen this so many other things, like you were saying about like the parodies of like art films with Rabbit's Moon. Like this movie has clearly echoed throughout all of the film history since.
Yeah, big time. And I was talking about this with a friend recently that like, I know there are some segmented listeners out there that are going to lambast me for this, but one of the reasons that I've never been like a complete Martin Scorsese devotee is I know at this point a lot of his reference points. I know a lot of the films that inspired him, and I can't help but watch something like Raging Bull and feel like, well, this is great, but it's not quite as great as Rocco and His Brothers, which is really referencing, or Last Temptation of Christ, which is another big favorite of mine, but it's like, it's also not quite as good as The Gospel According to Matthew. And similarly, like I watched the way pop music is used in this, and I'm like, man, this is really taking a dig out of Mean Streets and Goodfellas and a bunch of other stuff. It's like, it's, I still like Scorsese. Don't come for me, listeners, but seeing the id of where Scorsese was inspired, and Scorsese will own up to this as much as I'm accusing him of, was really informative. And like part of the reason the film struck me so much is like, oh, this is the essence of the thing that was really appealing to me in a lot of what Scorsese was doing, is like getting the exciting montage set to like My Boyfriend's Back, or then like, okay, so like halfway through the film, the Crystals' He's a Rebel hits, which is a great song. I totally love it. But then it's intercut the biker stuff with like Jesus walking down the road with the 12 disciples. It's like, see the way he's walked down the street. And it's like Jesus strutting with his 12 disciples. It's like, that's pretty cool. And that apparently came up by total accident. Anger claims at least that this film, which was a like silent era Jesus film, was supposed to go to a church, but accidentally got delivered to his doorstep. And he's just like, oh, wow. Well, this will fit with Scorpio's Rising. Again, as with anything with anger, who knows how true it is, but like, it does kind of work on a very instinctive level that I can't totally explain, except to say that like, there's a slight religious adulation to the way he films the biker stuff that then kind of folds into the Nazi imagery and the just kind of the general, like religious fervor that can come across with any kind of subculture.
The film is apparently called The Living Bible, Last Journey to Jerusalem, according to Wikipedia. We can move straight from Scorpio Rising into Custom Car Commandos, because they have a lot in common in terms of being fetishy, vehicular-related stuff. He got the funding from the Ford Foundation to make this movie about cars, I guess, but it's I guess steering back from Scorpio Rising, there is no nudity in this, but it is maybe the most homoerotic thing I've ever seen. It's just like two guys polishing a car. The chrome, the way the light shines off the chrome, I love the way, I mean, I feel like I was saying this with Rabbit's Moon, and I don't know how to say it in the right. Like, I feel like when we talk about Kenneth Anger, or when people talk about Kenneth Anger, and I think we've been doing it too, we're talking so much about like the context, the mise-en-scene, what's in the what he's depicting, because it was like ahead of its time and stuff.
Yeah.
But he and his collaborators were clearly such just talented filmmakers. The way the way that Custom Car Commandos is framed and lit is breathtaking. Like, there's a shot of the interior of a car from outside, and the way the light comes in and reflects off of the gear shift, it all like took my breath away. It also is so bright that I was like, if I saw this in Dolby Vision, I might go blind from how like just how hot the like the reflections are with that like harsh white light. Like it's beautiful. And yeah, the movie is just two guys working on cars and manipulating engines in ways that is really erotic, even though they're not, it could get past censors, I guess, because they aren't actually doing anything sexual.
Yeah, not actually, but definitely implied. And yeah, this was another one that was supposed to be a much longer, I don't know, film, I guess. And he talked about in the commentary that like Commandos was chosen for a reason, that there were supposed to be multiple cars and multiple Commandos, but ultimately they were only able to film the one. But yeah, I was also very taken with this on a very just immediate pleasure level of like, it's cool to see good looking people polish good looking cars.
Yeah. Okay. So, now we're steering right back into the occult, pretty far back into the occult.
Oh yeah.
With Invocation of My Demon Brother, which, has a whole lot of these like, connections. Because at some point in here, he became involved with Anton LaVey, the head of the, you know, whatever, Church of Church Satan.
Yeah.
Manson family associate and future murderer Bobby Beausoleil.
Yeah.
Is in this one, and then it continues to work with him later as well. But yeah, I don't know. I'm giving a lot of background, but what do you have to say about this movie? I think you've watched it more recently than I have.
Yeah, I mean, it's also another one that's, you know, tough to summarize. I think even more so than the ones that came before it, because it's a little more jumbled in terms of what it's precisely depicting. But there is a sense of like, so this was made in 1969, or at least premiered there then in some capacity, and it seemed to me to kind of capture that feeling of the late 60s of like, you have these kind of classically all-American good-looking guys, but in a slightly seedier context. This is, at least to my memory, the first one to have all-out nudity. Is that correct? Am I forgetting something?
Well, I mean, Scorpio Rising had naked dudes, right?
I can't remember if they end up getting nude or if it's just like really close to that. Okay. There's still a sense of like, maybe it's also because the soundtrack is an electronic score that Mick Jagger arranged. And so there's a sense, whereas Scorpio Rising has the kind of classic pop tunes going to it. There's also footage of like, I don't know if it's Vietnam explicitly, but certainly inferred to be, of kind of soldiers marching off of helicopters and stuff. You get the sense of like that end of the 60s sensation of some sense of the world passing and something very chaotic and very violent and very new replacing it, that is unpredictable and dangerous and very hostile to even the kind of classic Americana that Anger dealt with, which was always something he was like kind of attacking, but it was also something he slightly embraced. One of the amusing comments I found in one of his commentary tracks is he was like, I guess he just wasn't a fan of the Beatles because they were like, he claimed they ruined American pop music for the rest of the decade. But he, you know, in spite of the fact that he was constantly challenging norms, as we've kind of discussed in earlier films, he also had a great affection for that pop music, for silent films, for kind of the classic Americana. But here he seems to capture it all kind of disintegrating and devolving into something really uncomfortable.
That's well said. I was looking at who else. So I guess the movie is about sort of bringing a demon forth, Invocation of My Demon Brother. I should have thought of that. But Anton LaVey appears in it. And it says Mick Jagger appears in it.
Yeah, very briefly. There's a shot of him at it. I mean, basically, it's like concert footage. And then, yeah, Bobby Beausoleil is in it as well. In the commentary track, Anger seems less concerned with the murdering than like, he was like, He later copied my tattoo. I really thought that was poor form, especially because he has such a beautiful body. It really didn't need the tattoo. I was like, this is your big concern? Okay.
Yeah.
Go off, man.
Yeah, but I, so we're near the end of the like main stretch here.
Yeah.
And I've talked about Anton LaVey, but I haven't talked about Aleister Crowley, who died before Anger was born, but that he was, who he was obsessed with, and a lot of the stuff and things like Inauguration of the Pleasure Dome and Invocation of a Demon Brother are influenced by Aleister Crowley and his sort of is Aleister Crowley the first one who said do what thou wilt is the whole of the law or something like that?
I don't know.
I think that's a saying that is often associated with the Satanist like point of view, hedonism, but that's where that I think that's Aleister Crowley. And Aleister Crowley was someone who was also very shady about his background and kind of thing. It clearly took a lot for that, so I didn't want to move on to the end before at least mentioning Aleister Crowley. But at the end we get kind of what I think he saw as his like I don't know if masterpiece is the word, but his major statement, which was Lucifer Rising, which he made for over 10 years.
Yeah, I mean there's a sense of like a culmination to it for sure. Yeah.
And I get it. I think Lucifer Rising might be my favorite of the films. The score, by the way, is by Bobby Beausoleil.
Yeah.
After he was in prison.
Yeah.
He wrote the score from prison.
It's fascinating.
After he murdered someone. Yeah. There is, I've looked it up. There is a story here. I'm not going to pretend that while I was watching the movie, I was like really following what the story was. Were you?
No, I mean, any story I gleaned from it came from, reading up on it later. Most of what I was responding to was like a sensation that the movie is giving me.
Yeah. But you've got, this one was shot, it's clearly a big project because you've got like on location stuff from different parts of the world.
It seems huge.
Yeah. Marianne Faithfull is walking around among the pyramids.
Yeah.
There's stuff that's shot. Let's see. I'm trying to think, see if he shot stuff. No, he like visited Crowley's mansion, but I don't know if he shot anything there. But it's all over the place, and it feels very like you said, culmination. It feels like there's a lot of like sort of hands up to the sky, like in Rabbit's Moon, and shots of the sun and stuff. And it does feel like a kind of ecstatic ritual celebration by the end.
Yeah, for sure. I unfortunately don't have a lot of insights to add to it other than, it's one that I want to revisit, and I have it playing right now, but I want to keep going back to it, as with many of these shorts.
Yeah, I definitely will do that too.
Glean more from it because it feels a little bit more than I could take in on one viewing, but incorporate so many of the techniques, I would say, that he had been exploring in past films, in the kind of like elaborate costume design. And we haven't really talked about his use of like superimpositions and kind of layering images on top of each other, which I'm always like a gigantic fan of as like a big Tony Scott guy. But
I mentioned dissolves a little bit with Ode to Artifice, but that didn't go away there. Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Lucifer Rising is based upon the Thelemite concept that mankind had entered a new period known as the Aeon of Horus. So now we know what it's about.
Of course, we all know the Aeon of Horus.
I mentioned Marianne Faithfull is in it. Kenneth Anger, we haven't talked about how like he's in this, and he was in Pleasure Dome and My Demon Brother. He shows up in a lot of his own movies.
Also Fireworks as well. He's the main guy.
Right. He's the main guy. Yeah. Also, Donald Kamel, the who directed co-directed Performance with Nicholas Rogue, is in this, and of course he would go on to make a Tyler and David favorite, Demon Seed, the movie about the smart house who traps and then rapes and impregnates Julie Christie. I don't know if you've ever seen.
I have not seen Demon Seed, but now I, with that description, very much want to.
It's a very good movie. And then he made another movie in the '80s called White of the Eye that, I think maybe Scream Factory put out. That's really cool. But, so yeah, just more of those connections with people. I don't know what else to say. Well, his movies are hard to describe.
Here's honestly. The main question I have as we reach kind of the end of the BFI disc. And I tried to look this up a little bit, but why do you think this is considered like the Magic Lantern Cycle? why are these films grouped together? Yeah.
I don't know. I know that I'm glad you brought up the word magic because, Anger often used the word magic and spelled it with a K on the end.
Right.
And that's another thing that he took from Aleister Crowley. That was, Aleister Crowley wanted to make sure that his definition of magic was seen as something different than sort of like illusions and showmanship. So he spelled it with a K on the end. And that's where it comes from. But as far as why it's called the Magic Lantern Cycle, I don't know. It's, you probably have to read a lot of Aleister Crowley and maybe you'd figure it out.
Yeah, it seems, I don't know, some of what I was reading suggested that it was like Kenneth Anger needed money and needed a way to package the work that he had done.
Okay.
And just kind of like grouped his extant films into a collection that could be shown together. Because, I mean, anyone who has any engagement with short films know they're often at best shuffled to the beginning of festival program, you know, before the main feature, maybe in a shorts program collectively that nobody will go see, but generally exhibition for short films is very lacking, and so potentially this was a way to at least create a feature program out of it that people would attend and pay for. But yeah, other than that, I had a very hard time finding much connective tissue that wasn't just like routine auteurist stuff that generally comes up when you collect a filmmaker's work together.
Especially, like I said, like there is some overlap, but I feel like if you could tell someone who didn't know, I think that Custom Car Commandos and Invocation of My Demon Brother were made by different directors, and I think
totally
they would assume that you were not lying to them.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, so I tried to figure out if there's any meaning to it beyond that, but it did seem kind of just like ad hoc, you know, made up in the moment kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think my vocabulary is failing as I get older. It encapsulates the most prolific and most the years that he was most celebrated, I guess.
Well, and most active. I mean, just looking at kind of the Wikipedia list that you and I are going off of, you know, he had a series of films after Lucifer Rising, or rather during Lucifer Rising, that were announced but never produced. And then his next produced film was in the year 2000. So Lucifer Rising like completes in 1980. And then, at least according to his Wikipedia list, there's nothing else until 2000, which is insane. And I don't know what he was living on between those 2 points, maybe just showing the Magic Lantern Cycle. But I did see some of the films he made after this point. So if you want to move on, I can briefly discuss those.
Yeah, let's move on. Like I said, I did watch the one, Hang. But you watched, I'm guessing, Don't Smoke That Cigarette?
I did. Don't Smoke That Cigarette is his longest film at a staggering 45 minutes.
How'd you get through it?
I know. I say this both as a joke and because it's literally true. It took me 2 viewings just because of like how it fit in my schedule kind of thing. It's fine. It's so apparently Kenneth Anger, which is unusual for the generation he belonged to, was not a smoker and kind of recognized early on the dangers of smoking. And so, as the title implies, it's about both the culture of smoking and the dangers of it. So it takes a lot of footage from sitcoms and cigarette advertisements of the 1940s and 50s and 60s, and then contrasts those with kind of the growing publicization of the dangers of smoking. So you get like snippets of doctors saying like, we're noticing an uptick in lung cancer patients due to cigarette smoking. Maybe watch out for that kind of stuff. And into some very, like, those of us who had to endure high school health class, even though we were never in danger of ever taking up anything remotely outside of what was prescribed by our parents. I'm speaking for myself here. Just, like, really horrifying stuff of the effects of smoking, which, like, I hated enduring health classes. Like, I'm not going to do any shit. Just don't show me another, like, deteriorated liver. I can't take it anymore. So the film contrasts like those two things of like just how prevalent cigarette advertising was for a period of American history.
You've got some Gen Z in you.
I do have a little bit of Gen Z in me. To
cigarettes. Every time, because it's first it was the Jenna Ortega clip went viral of her having a cigarette, and now it's Timothy Chalamet. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah.
Of him having a cigarette, and American Gen Z people just like disgusted and freaked out, and I mostly just keep it my reaction to myself, because on the one hand, like, yeah, cigarettes are awful for you. I wish I had never smoked. No one should smoke. They're really bad, and it's a waste of money and time and everything, but also, like, they sound like such fucking dorks.
Yeah, that's kind of why I stay out of it, too, because, like, as you kind of figure out when you're watching this film, it's like, yeah, there's a reason everyone was smoking. It does look cool, and they show like clips of like old 40s films of like movie stars smoking. It's like, yeah, it does look cool. There's no getting around it. But it is kind of an interesting reflection on, because by 2000, I mean, I have memories of this period of like going to restaurants in the 90s and like being asked if we were in the smoking or non-smoking section. And there was kind of an inflection point around this period of like cigarette acceptance in mainstream American culture. And so the film comes out at an interesting point. Whether it needed 45 minutes to kind of elaborate on that point, debatable. It kind of goes on and regurgitates the same thing over and over. But it is interesting to think about a period in American history where even goes back as far as like the idea that cigarettes were at most a vice, you know, like it gets to that period. And you see this for people who watch Mad Men, where like there was a turn where like, okay, everyone recognizes the danger to smoking. So you get like the doctors that can recommend like the okay cigarettes. But seeing the period of advertising from before then, when it was like, just like, yeah, this thing we all do, this is the best one. Smoke some, was also really interesting too. So yeah, from there, you get The Man We Want to Hang, which I know you saw, and which I was not terribly into.
Yeah, I liked the music again. He's very particular with music. I was not familiar with it. The composer is a Russian composer named Anatoly Liadov.
Yeah.
I liked the music a lot. But it was like, it's just 12 minutes of images of Aleister Crowley's artwork that I think was, so he did this for like a some sort of installation or art show, I think.
Sure. I don't know. That sounds good.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't feel, I wasn't bored by it, but it's only 12 minutes and the music was good.
Of course.
Yeah. Paintings are fine. But yeah, I guess, that idea of commissioning something, a film as a tribute to a visual artist from another medium for an installation feels very Straub-Huillet.
Totally.
Except when they did it for Cézanne, they used so little of Cézanne's actual artwork that the museum rejected it. All right.
Well, so there's no danger of that here. Yeah. Plenty of his artwork on display.
Yeah.
So yeah, from there, his next film was Anger Sees Red, which is a really cool film. Loosely, it's like there's kind of a muscled man hanging out, sunbathing. And I didn't quite clock this while I was watching it, but Anger himself is kind of like the perspective of the film, who's kind of watching this guy walk around the park. But it's just like the classic Kenneth Anger, very homoerotic, very sexually charged, images and a lot of really inventive and creative editing on display. So I was really glad to see that. The next film on this list is not available, which I'm very much curious to find. It's called Patriotic Penis. Great name. We'd love to know what that's all about. But then after that, he made a really interesting film called Mouse Heaven, which is a montage of Mickey Mouse memorabilia that kind of has like this jazzy background music to it. That like, I mean, I guess you could say it's a reflection on American consumerism or like Disney influenced media or whatever else. But it's also just like really cool to watch him play around with these objects and kind of repurpose them in kind of a slightly overwhelming and grotesque way of just seeing these different images of Mickey just kind of like, I don't know, hurled at the viewer again and again and again. It was pretty cool. I have less to say, even less than that, to say about My Surfing Lucifer, which is like a surf film, I guess. It's like this guy's surfing around. All right, that's all I gleaned from it. This has no sound to it even, so hard to really hang your hat onto much. But at 4 minutes, you know, it's an amusing watch. Less amusing is his 35-minute film Ich Will, which is a montage of Nazi youth propaganda films, which even more so than Don't Smoke That Cigarette goes on and on about making the same point of displaying what Nazi propaganda was all about. It does have, which I don't think I've ever seen before, some footage of Adolf Hitler hosting a rally and seeming like entirely bored with the proceedings, which at least is like unusual. He's just kind of like loosely giving the like hail salute to the crowd, and the crowd's like overwhelmingly like thrilled to see him at all. But is mostly just kind of like, Nazism was quite a sensation, and we realized in retrospect it was bad, and should have realized more at the time. And he sure got a lot of people on board with it. And, you know, there's some inventive manipulation of the footage, but not enough that really is kind of worth investing in. It's probably the dullest of all the work that Fizzle saw. His last film, though, Missoni, was really cool. And we talked earlier about Custom Cars Commando, whatever the word.
Custom Car Commandos.
As being like this kind of work on the behest of a larger corporate entity. Missoni was commissioned by an Italian designer who, you know, Missoni makes very high-end clothes, and so the film was commissioned as a 2.5-minute piece, commissioned essentially probably to sell those clothes, but has like, you can clearly tell he had some money at his hand at this, because it's got like gorgeous models and nonstop inventive editing, and it's a really, really cool sit if you can track it down. It's the only work of his, I think, from this later period. I guess I really did like Mouse Heaven, but and Anglesey's Red, but this one really tapped into that feeling that I was getting from the Magic Lantern Cycle of some really avant-garde stuff at play, even if it was at the behest of a larger corporate entity.
Yeah. Well, we did it.
That's it.
I did want to mention, you know, we made mention of Hollywood Babylon. I just want to mention something that I didn't know until I saw it on the Wikipedia page. So he wrote Hollywood Babylon and Hollywood Babylon 2. He wrote Hollywood Babylon 3, but I guess it has a lot of Scientology stuff and was threatened with like serious lawsuits.
That's what he says, at least. Yeah.
Okay. But another, I'm reading straight from the Wikipedia. Another book, Hollywood Babylon It's Back, written by Darwin Porter and Danforth Prince, was published in 2008 and purported to be part 3 of the Hollywood Babylon series. However, Anger had no involvement with it whatsoever. Indeed, Anger was so upset with the unauthorized work that he used his Thelema magic to curse Porter and Prince. He shut them.
Definitely. No. Did you read any of Hollywood Babylon?
No.
I read a little bit of it. I kind of skimmed it. It's interesting if a little exhausting. It's kind of all written in that kind of like blind item style of like page 6 reporting or whatever, but with names attached. So it's like, it's exciting for a couple paragraphs and then you're like, oh, there's a whole book of this. And like, I kept kind of flipping through and like, see if it kind of changed it up in style. it's interesting, but, you know, as has been widely reported by this point, you know, not widely credible as far as actual history goes. And so I was kind of hoping it would at least be exciting reading, which it is in fits and spurts. And I think if you read it kind of a chapter at a time, but kind of taking it all in a big chunk proved a little exhausting for me. But definitely speaks to the sort of excitement he got from silent films. And like, you get the sensation of someone who's very engaged in the details of history, even if, as one historian put it, he was essentially like constructing out of mental telepathy, because there's like no sources cited for anything he's writing down. Very little like context given to the things. Just like, here's what happens according to me, I guess. But you can definitely see how it influenced Damien Chazelle's Babylon. That energy is very much in the reading of it.
Cool. I probably won't check it out.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think this was great. You can, of course, find, I mean, there's no Kenneth Anger reviews at BattleshipRetention.com, but there's other stuff at BattleshipRetention.com, including my other podcast, the one where I met your mother. Check that out. I'm sure Kenneth Anger would have loved it. For all I know, he was a listener up until the end there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, follow me on Twitter, follow me on Blue Sky if you have Blue Sky. Both are Davey Pretension. I'll be updating from Toronto there and posting some reviews on the website there. So yeah, on Letterboxd at David Bax. I think that's the David at BattleshipRetention.com. Scott, where can people find you if you want?
On Twitter and Blue Sky, Rail of Tomorrow, and on Letterboxd, where I'm once again trying to at least post more frequently for my own sake. I've been kind of going back on like earlier logs I made of films, and I'm always disappointed when I don't have notes up, because then I'm like, what did I think of that film? What were the things that actually stood out to me? So I'm trying to log more notes, at least for my own sake, and hopefully others get something out of them. Should have reviews up on the site soon for a couple more Kino Lorber discs that I'm reviewing, and possibly some theatrical stuff as well, which I should talk to you about off mic.
Cool. We'll do that now. All right. So thanks everybody for listening.
Hey, we'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.